This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Whoops, big mistake. Just this past week, the state tax office notified some 300 rental car companies that a law that was going to go to an effect this year is flawed. It was meant to charge a $2 a day fee on rental cars, primarily on visitors. But a serious oversight by the Attorney General's office left taxpayers open to a lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of that law. That fee will now have to be applied to Hawaii residents as well. That meant trying to find a bill to correct the legal misstep this legislative session. We sat down with State Tax Director Linda Chu Takayama about the problem and the fix, which is in progress.
Last year's legislature passed a $2 a day fee on the rental car charges. And the fee was meant to go to cover county roads, the repair and maintenance of county roads. And it was to be applied, or there was an exemption for the surcharge for anybody who had a Hawaii driver's license. And that created a problem. Somebody raised the issue of constitutionality because it was not applied evenly to everybody. And under the Constitution, under the Commerce Clause, you really can't have a separate category for residents and non-residents.
Okay, and that fee was supposed to kick in this year?
It was supposed to have kicked in January, and in fact, there were a number of rental car companies that did start charging for it. We had to call a halt to that as soon as we found out about this question on the constitutionality, and we asked the legislature to figure out what to do about that. In the meantime, from the tax department, we told the rental car companies to stop charging, stop collecting that additional fee. In the meantime, the legislature is passing through a bill that would have the $2 surcharge apply to everybody, both residents and non-residents alike. And that is underway in the legislative process, and I expect to hear soon as to whether that's going to be finally adopted or not.
You think that's going to come this week?
Oh, no, probably no. Not.
Okay, all right. So the bottom line is then it's got, everybody's got to pay. And maybe there'll be more money for the counties to use?
There'll be a little bit more money. I don't know that residents really do a lot of car rental here in Hawaii. So there'll be a little bit more, but I'm not sure a lot more. In any case, that money goes not to the general fund, but to a county fund to take care of the roads.
So essentially, though, you and I would be paying if we were to go to the neighbor islands and rent a car.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
Or vice versa.
Yes.
So I guess we went through this whole process, though, not realizing that we didn't look at a certain portion of the law that would have to apply fairly.
The Attorney General's office was asked the question early on in the legislative session last year, and for whatever reason, they kind of missed this. It's called the Dormant Commerce Clause. And when it was raised this year, it was, oops, you know, we need to fix this.
So rather than run afoul and be sued, we just figured, okay, we've got to level the playing field, apply this fairly across the board.
Correct.
So we can expect to then pay this fee later this year?
Later this year, we'll know when the bill finally passes what the effective date will be. It probably will be something like July 1.
Okay. And then do we know how much it was supposed to raise? Do you have a handle?
I'm sorry. I don't have that information offhand. Yeah.
Okay. You know, I think people probably think, well, you know, we do something similar with Hanama Bay. You know, mm-hmm. if you have a driver's license, that you don't have to pay a huge admission price, and the tourists pay.
And I think it was something along those lines, especially with rental cars. For the most part, it's the non-residents who are renting these cars. And so, you know, to get them to pay their fair share of the wear and tear on the roads was I think that was the concept.
All right, but the bottom line is, everybody should be prepared to pay the $2 surcharge.
$2 a day if they're renting a car.
How did we return the money for the folks that had been charged that $2? Do you know how the rental companies did that?
I'm not sure how they did. We have advised them to stop collecting it and that we would settle out with them if they've already paid it to us by credits going forward. Now, how they deal with their customers, you know, we kind of left it up to them.
Okay, so did that just go out What, this week?
The notification went out, would have been last week or maybe the week before. We sent out notification to 300 rental car companies. I'm not sure all of them are necessarily active, but they were the ones that were on our list of taxpayers.
Takayama said it was the Hawaii Tax Foundation that flagged the state's error. And one other major fix is for a system to hear some 200 tax appeal cases, which Takayama estimates has some $53 million in dispute. Currently, the state has volunteer tax boards assigned to each county to hear disputes. But right now, only Hawaii County has a full five-member board operating, with scores of cases in limbo on other islands, as those boards haven't met in more than a year. The administration is proposing that the state have a single professional board to ensure it has a system in place to deal with disputes with taxpayers over how much they're owed or how much they have to pay. And since tax day is right around the corner, we also took the time to talk about what's different this year that filers need to know about.
A couple of things. One is we urge people to, if they can, file electronically. We have the Hawaii Tax Online program that allows people to file electronically. The thing that's new this time is, number one, we didn't really have it available much before, but we do have it available now, and it's free. Taxpayers do have the option of going to some of the commercial services like TurboTax, for instance. TurboTax, you are required to pay to file. Although their program is a much more sophisticated program, it'll walk you through each one of the various kinds of deductions and so on, whereas the tax department's program is pretty vanilla. It'll show you the form and you fill out the form, but it's free. So, you know, you have those kinds of choices depending on, you know, how familiar you are with the tax system. We also have available a fraud detection program where if you're concerned about your tax information being secure, what you can do is make application to the tax fraud program. And what happens is that when you file your tax return, you can validate this is really me filing. Because one of the familiar fraud issues is someone stealing your identity, filing a tax return in your name, and getting a refund sent to his or her personal address as opposed to yours.
And you never know that.
I
recall that the feds sent an IRS spokesman out here to talk about that very issue because they were seeing an unusual spike in that.
There's a lot of identity theft going around, and certainly we are concerned about that with tax returns.
Have we been able to institute either new systems with our modernization rolled out?
These fraudsters are very smart, and it's hard to stay, you know, one step ahead of them. So we do have fraud filters on the program, and we do have staff who are designated to look at those returns that are kicked out as potential fraud. So we do have that. We have this identity theft protection program that taxpayers can sign up to. So we do what we can. In the case of depending on what kind of fraud we uncover, we have a criminal investigation unit that's set up to investigate any kind of fraud that looks like it might be criminal in nature.
But basically, you then have an avenue for folks who may be victims of this type of fraud to be able to get some kind of relief or customer service response quickly.
We do. I don't know that it's not necessarily set up to get their money back for them, but to really identify who's conducting the fraud and to shut them down. And we have the identity theft protection program set up for folks who have a concern about their identity being stolen. And it's more of a proactive kind of a program.
Right, because I think this past year we've seen a lot of data breaches and a lot of sensitive information that's kind of out there in the universe, and everybody's just waiting to see, you know, if there's unusual activity on their
accounts.
You never
know. Yeah, so if there's a concern, sign up for the identity theft program. It's all online at hawaiitax.hawaii.gov.
Anything else that you think would be top of mind?
A couple of things. One is the actual hard copy of your tax forms. We're trying to move away from that and hopefully get more folks to file online. All of the tax forms and the tax booklets are available online. In fact, we've cut back a lot from having these available, for instance, at the libraries. We used to give the library stacks and stacks of instruction booklets and forms and whatnot. We still give them the forms. We've cut down on the number of booklets. So I think we give them maybe a handful of booklets. So you're supposed to look at them either online or at the library instead of taking them away with you. Because what we were finding this year in conducting our own inventory, each library was throwing away thousands of booklets. We were spending hundreds of thousands of dollars printing them.
Wow.
And so we're cutting back considerably. And so some folks are getting a little annoyed at that because we were mailing out booklets in the past. And of the, I don't know what it was something like 30,000 booklets or so, there were only maybe, you know, 10 or 15 that were actually turned in. So this year was the last year we were actually mailing out booklets.
Okay, well, I did see them at the library last week.
There you go.
So they're out there.
Yeah, so next year probably, we haven't made the final decision yet, but I'm inclined to think we were not going to mail out any. And, you know, they're available enough, whether it's at the tax office, at the libraries, or, like I said, online.
That was State Tax Director Linda Chu Takayama talking about tax time and critical bills in play this legislative session. And FYI, Wallet Hub today shared its list of best and worst taxpayer states with return on investment, and Hawaii was last.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, we look at the sports industry from the labor side of the equation.
Sports is as close to a meritocracy as we have, and that doesn't extend to the business of sports.
What's it like to be an employee in one of the most prominent and volatile industries in the world?
It's a pretty typical fighter story to be broke and trying to make it, you know.
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio.
This evening at 7.
Hi, my name is Avi Soifer, and I am the Dean of the William S. Richardson School of Law at the University of Hawaii, and we are pleased to be underwriters for HPR. Well, we've been involved in many ways with the station. We wanted to reach out into the community for our evening program in particular. We've always been about opportunity, and we had to get the word out about this program, and the perfect way to do it was through HPR.
Hawaii Public Radio Underwriting, your message heard here.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. In today's backyard quiz, we're looking at two of Hawaii's greatest natural assets, Kilauea and Haleakala. A bill introduced in Washington in 1916 made them national parklands, and perhaps you visited in the past or have them on your bucket list. Well, the Hawaii National Park Bill, taken up by the 64th Congress, reads that the designated tracts of land, quote, shall be perpetually dedicated and set apart as a public park or pleasure ground for the enjoyment of the people of the United States. Legislation discussed during that same session created the National Park Service and was introduced by Hawaii's delegate to the U.S. Congress, a man who left a significant mark on modern-day Hawaii. Your question for this morning, who was he? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Hi, aloha. I'm Ken Lawson from the Hawaii Innocence Project. If you like today's music, find the playlist at The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
It's been about a year and a half since the deadly high-rise fire that killed several residents at the Marco Polo building. We now know that this past week, the high-rise turned a corner on renovations following the devastating blaze that displaced scores of property owners and renters. Longtime resident Tom Schmidt is still waiting for construction to be complete on his unit. He lived on the 26th floor across from where the fire broke out and where his neighbors died. Associate Hawaii marked the construction milestone with a gathering last week to thank the construction workers, firefighters, and residents. Honolulu Mayor Kirk Caldwell also stopped by for the blessing and rededication. Here's more from Tom Schmidt.
Most of them were displaced are back in, but the people got really burned out. They're still putting their interiors in. Like in our unit, they haven't put in our windows yet. We still have drywall that they have to replace, and electrical doesn't work, and I guess they'll get around to all of it sooner or later. But I'd say there's 30 units where people are not in yet. Right now, we're living over in Kailua until they finish our unit. I would say they got, 6 months of work to do yet.
Gotcha.
Plus
okay.
The sprinkler system.
I did see an article about some issue with the asbestos cleaning. Did they discuss that at all?
No, nobody, they kept it positive at this meeting. They didn't talk about anything negative. They didn't say the word mold. They didn't say the word asbestos.
Now, Schmidt tells us that work to install a sprinkler system will begin in about 2 months, but getting other older high-rises to follow suit is more of a challenge. The Honolulu City Council is still grappling with how best to tweak a mandatory sprinkler bill for aging buildings who are unprotected. Now, just yesterday, the Honolulu City Council Committee on Public Infrastructure, Technology, and Sustainability heard testimony for Bill 96. It's an ordinance which covers fire safety measures and assessments for the protection of residents and property in existing high-rise residential buildings. The bill pauses the time period and deadlines in a revised building fire and life safety evaluation form. The Honolulu Fire Department submitted a revised list of 400-plus buildings that are covered by the process. Committee Chair Carol Fukunaga discussed the current draft with Assistant Fire Chief Socrates Bertakos.
Because there was that confusion that arose during the implementation between the 75-foot standard in the building code versus the 10 stories, which, the fire department had agreed that that was really the threshold, beyond which they were going to be focusing most actively on fire sprinkler installations, et cetera. We now have in this draft a requirement that any building basically over 75 feet is going to have to comply with or go through this life safety evaluation process. So, for those buildings that were 8 stories and above, below 10 stories that are now subject to the requirement, it's sort of a big surprise to those buildings. But for everyone that responded to the fire department's initial letters asking them if they intended to comply, we think it's fair to include the list of buildings that the fire department has identified, so at least people know they're either in or they're out, because in many instances it is very disruptive, which is kind of why we wanted to give people some assurance that here's the list that the fire department has vetted, the council has reviewed, people have commented to us to say that, we want to make sure that the list is accurate. So I think that's really our objective, to have an accurate listing that everyone can rely on.
Okay, and we understand the chair's intent. We note that the time period for the evaluation stays the same, 3 years from May 3rd, 2018, so we're good with that. I think we might have said before, we're not in favor of the tolling because of permitting processes that might take longer, and that's because we already have mechanisms to take care of that. We see that when people make substantial efforts and they are submitting, that we don't penalize them. We give them more time. That's in general how we run fire code issues. right now with our everyday inspections and plans that are submitted to us.
HFD opposes that bill in its current form for technical reasons. And Jane Sugimura, the president of the Hawaii Council of Apartment Owners, also testified on the bill yesterday.
Regarding the change to the 3 and 6 year deadlines, I told the chief we're not asking for any extensions on the 3 year deadline because that doesn't include building permits. And we were asking for an extension on the 6 year for the time that if a building has to get a building permit. And he's assured me that, you know, this is the practice of the city and the fire department, that they would grant those extensions without anything being in the ordinance. And I told him, you know, he and Chief Wayne aren't going to be around forever. And if they were going to be here forever, then I wouldn't have any concern. But, you know, we are dealing with a government agency, and we would like some assurance that if for some reason, you know, a building permit is applied for and it results in delay in compliance, you know, if you put language in there that says that if there is a delay and it's caused, you know, that the city will be flexible in reviewing requests for extensions or something like that.
Chair Carol Fukunaga deferred action on Bill 96 until Wednesday, March 27th at 2 p.m.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Manoa Valley Theater, presenting Allegiance at the Hawaii Theater, based on the real-life experiences of George Takei and his family interned during World War II. Opens Thursday. Tickets at hawaiitheater.com.
We've been covering lots of different topics and following our recent coverage about the Honolulu City Council working to regulate vacation rentals. Isla left us this message on our talkback line.
Everybody on Oahu seems to be a little bit out of shape over these vacation rentals. But the thing is, nearly every home on this island that's zoned single family has made a second unit, even if with it being a long-term rental. And the other thing is, I really don't understand why all over in Kauai you have auto body shops and all kinds of industrial buildings with apartment houses with little kids breathing in fumes from spray booths, you know, literally a few feet away next door. I just don't understand how that can be okay, and everyone's worried about vacation rentals in Kailua. Okay, that's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
And following our show with State Highways Deputy Director Ed Sniffen about a proposed road usage plan, we got this from a listener. How about using the gross vehicle weight multiplied by the miles driven to be our road use tax? I have a small gas car, a Honda Fit, and I'm sure it causes less road maintenance than a large heavy electric or plug-in hybrid such as a Tesla SUV, and that was sent in by Stanton Lum of Makiki. And Janet called in after last week's conversation with Civil Beat's John Hill about an acupuncturist who pushed for oversight being under investigation.
My name is Janet Boyd. It was this show that I heard about acupuncturists and the regulation, and I was greatly outraged. I'm a licensed acupuncturist in the state of Hawaii and two other states. And I found that conversation offensive and incorrect. And I'm sorry, you know, there are things that are going on. I'm on the Hawaii Acupuncture Association board, so not the regulatory one. It's just wrong. And I think the information was poorly presented and not fully correct. I just think it's a smear campaign against acupuncturists. And, yeah, I was not pleased, and I listened to the radio all the time. Okay.
And Christine had this suggestion.
Aloha. My name is Christine Kubat. I'm calling not with a comment, but with a suggestion for a show. I'm very much involved with people of all ages in the zero waste movement statewide. Mostly I'm active on the Big Island. And over here in the Big Island, our Department of Environmental Management is getting ready to roll out a new program to make changes. They're going to be making changes to the recycling program that they have here. So they need to get some exposure for those changes. And I thought it would be really interesting and helpful to people to have a conversation not only with them, but with people who are trying to expand recycling beyond the current limits. Okay, thank you. Bye.
Hey, thanks for your comments. You can always tell us what's on your mind by calling our talkback line at 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Hawaii Symphony Orchestra, presenting Disney in Concert, music and video clips from movies such as Frozen, featuring four vocal artists this Saturday and Sunday. HawaiiSymphonyOrchestra.org.
It's now time for our reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. Business reporter Stuart Yurton's on the line. So you have an interesting take on the Kaka'ako condo situation.
Yes. Well, we went down and started talking to people down there who are involved in designing, doing a lot of the interior design work. You know, we have thousands of new condo units, and we were curious, well, are people benefiting from these local workers and artisans and artists? And we found out that, well, they are.
So, yeah, I imagine that if folks want, like, kind of a unit with an island touch, right, island flavor, they'll be looking for things that are made here.
Yeah, and that's what we're seeing. And again, it's very hard to quantify, but anecdotally, we talk to people. We talk to, again, to interior designers and some of the artisans themselves who are providing things, and we found out that, yeah, there is a substantial amount of work that's going into these into the condos. Again, it's up to the decorators really to be able to do it. And make that connection between the condo owners and these artisans who are really working on their own all over town, doing things like furniture making, designing things like tables, dining room tables, and other things, and art for the walls and that sort of thing.
Well, we have heard lots about how a lot of the local people can't afford those condos, so you are getting either mainland buyers or foreign buyers that are buying these luxury condos.
Yeah, that's, you know, obviously that's part of the story. I mean, we all know that. We all know about the sort of negative externalities of all this development, the increased traffic, the, you know, gentrification, things like that, and we all know about it and we see it. But there are also some positive things when it comes to the economy, and it is helping people. Again, what's really hard is to quantify this exactly. We do know that the creative industries are a really big part of our economy, or a sizable part of it. And this was a way to at least anecdotally get into it and start talking to people. So, and there's some really good people. I'm sorry.
No, so do these artists then have to have an in with these designers?
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, the designers are really the key people. And a lot of them really make an active effort to reach out to the artists. There are other artist groups, like we talked to a group called Emerge Collective, and they are bringing the artists together. So there's a group of artists. They know each other. They can make referrals. They're connected with some of the designers, like Mara Fujihara at Fish Cake. She's one of the people who's been a really great contact for people.
Right. So I imagine, though, that it's really artisans of all kinds, if you're a woodworker or a metal worker.
Yes, that's right. There are many different people. It's again, we have metal workers there. We have artists, artisans, and again, people like Mara Fujihira are really being great connectors to everybody. And again, some of the young people, too, are serving as these sort of conduits where people can gather together and make those connections. The real question is, how do we make more? And that's something that it's not exactly clear in how to sort of maximize the benefits of all this development.
Well, I know we've got lots of focus on the arts there with the powwow festival, a lot of kind of good synergy happening down in that area.
Right. I mean, Howard Hughes is really making a point of it. And again, we talked to them, and Todd Apoe, who's the sort of community relations person, said, you know, look, if we just build a bunch of buildings, it's really just a bunch of buildings and mixed-use development. We really need much more than that. So they're making an active effort to create things that people can go see down there. This is a little different. This is really more the people who are actually making things that go into the condos.
Yeah, it's making those connections. All right. Well, thanks so much, Stuart.
Thank you, Catherine.
That was business reporter Stuart Yurton with today's Reality Check. To read the full story, visit civilbeat.org. Humans are pumping a lot of carbon into our environment. Since most of those emissions come in the form of exhaust from power plants, ships, and cars, you might think that carbon stays in the atmosphere, but much of it is actually stored in the oceans. A team of international scientists spent 10 years measuring how our oceans absorb carbon and how that carbon changes oceans. Christopher Sabine is one of those scientists. He's an oceanographer at the University of Hawaii, and he spoke with HPR's Ryan Finnerty about this study.
Back in the late 80s and early 1990s, the global oceanographic community decided we needed to do a survey of the oceans to better understand how much carbon was being stored there from burning of fossil fuels. So we did this survey, and after completing that global survey, we realized that the oceans perhaps would not continue to take up the carbon dioxide as efficiently in the future, so we needed to repeat this survey periodically. So we started a program to go back and resurvey the oceans again. And so this paper that came out on Friday was the second global survey of carbon in the oceans. And we were looking at the changes in carbon between that initial assessment, which had a nominal mean time of 1994, until this survey, which has a nominal time of 2007. So we were looking at the change in carbon between those years.
And before we get to the findings, could you just explain how you actually go about taking those measurements?
Sure. We go out on a ship and go all the way across the ocean. Typically, it takes a month, between 1 and 2 months, to get across the ocean. And the ship stops every 30 nautical miles, and we send a package down, a computer and some bottles, down into the bottom of the ocean, and we collect that water from the surface all the way down to the bottom. We then bring it back up onto the ship. We subsample that water for different measurements, and we just keep doing that over and over again, stopping every 30 miles until we get all the way across the ocean. And we've got a whole grid pattern that we survey across all the different oceans of the world, from the Southern Ocean to the Arctic, and from the Pacific and the Atlantic and the Indian Ocean. And it takes about 10 years to complete that whole survey. And then we compile all the data and do our calculations with it at the end of that survey.
And so what did you find out?
And what we found is that between 1994 and 2007, the oceans had accumulated 34 petagrams of carbon. A peta is a 1 with 15 zeros after it. It's also equivalent to a billion metric tons. So what that means is we found that on average, the oceans are absorbing about 7 million metric tons of carbon every day. So that's a huge amount. And to kind of put that in perspective, because the numbers are so large, they're kind of difficult for people to grasp. But So if you were to convert that carbon into coal, right? So coal is almost pure carbon. And if you were to put that coal into a coal train, so just imagine a coal train, a hopper car full of coal, a train that would hold 1 year's equivalent of carbon in that train, it would wrap all the way around the Earth about 16 times.
So it's a ton of carbon that's being stored in the ocean.
It's a lot of carbon. So these people that say, oh, you know, humans really aren't doing enough to affect the Earth, if you just think about the magnitude of these numbers, that between 2007 and 1994, the oceans have absorbed 34 billion metric tons, and that's only 30% of what we released. A little less than half of what we release stays in the atmosphere. The rest is split between the ocean, and some of it also goes into what we call the terrestrial biosphere. Basically, it's the land, plants, and the trees.
How about the rate of absorption by the ocean? Because I've read that it's theorized that the oceans will eventually lose, they'll run out of capacity. They won't be able to take any more carbon in. There will be those, that train will get too long that you mentioned.
There is a concern that the oceans will become less efficient at taking up CO2. There's not really a chance that the oceans will stop taking up CO2 as long as CO2 continues to increase in the atmosphere. The oceans will continue to absorb it, but it will become less efficient at storing that CO2. So where today so what we found was from our survey in the 1990s, we found that the oceans were absorbing about 2 petagrams of carbon per year. Over the last couple of decades, it's been absorbing at a rate of about 2.6 petagrams of carbon per year. So the oceans are taking up more carbon dioxide today than they were. But that's also because the rate of increase of CO2 in the atmosphere is going up. So the faster we're burning it, we're releasing a lot more carbon into the atmosphere today than we were in the 1990s. So that's part of why the oceans are taking up more.
So it's not exactly clear.
Yeah. And so that's why we need to go back and keep measuring it. But it's also thought that the oceans will take up, become less efficient because there's kind of a two-layer system. What happens is the CO2 dissolves into the surface ocean. It's coming from the atmosphere, right? So it's dissolving into the surface ocean. But then there's a step where the ocean water moves down into the deep ocean, and it carries that fossil fuel carbon down into the deep ocean. That rate of circulation in the ocean is very slow. It takes about 1,500 years for water that sinks, for example, in the North Atlantic, until it sinks and it moves south, moves through the Southern Ocean, and comes back up into the Pacific, and it comes back up to the surface in the North Pacific. That whole process takes about 1,500 years. We've only been releasing carbon dioxide into the atmosphere for a little over 200 years. So most of the deep ocean, particularly in the Pacific, has never been exposed to the high CO2 concentrations that we have today. So that's why the oceans will continue to take up carbon dioxide, at least for the next 1,500 years.
Are we able to discern any type of environmental impact from all of this carbon going into the ocean, the way I'm thinking of algal blooms that can be caused from too much nitrogen being dumped into the water?
Absolutely. So carbon dioxide is what we call an acid gas. The CO2 reacts with water molecules to form carbonic acid. And that's causing something that we call ocean acidification. And so we're dropping the pH levels. We're acidifying the oceans, and that's not good for many organisms, particularly those that form calcium carbonate shells or skeletons. Think about your coral reefs, your oysters, your clams, the white sand beaches on Waikiki or around Hawaii. All those are made of calcium carbonate. And as we acidify the oceans, it becomes more and more difficult for those organisms to produce their shells. So the coral reefs cannot grow as quickly as they could in the pre-industrial times because of ocean acidification. And there's a whole suite of other impacts, some of which are not necessarily something you would think about. For example, the oceans are becoming more noisy because of added CO2 in the oceans. That's not something you would normally think about, but it turns out that borate ion is found in ocean water, and that's the primary compound in the oceans that absorbs sound. Well, as you add carbon dioxide to the water and you lower the pH, that decreases the concentration of borate ion in solution in the seawater, which means that the oceans don't absorb sound as quickly or as much as they used to, and therefore the oceans get more noisy, and that could potentially impact whales and dolphins and things that use echolocation.
That's really amazing. So there are really some very significant second and third order effects to this process of carbon sequestration. Dr. Christopher Sabine, thank you very much for joining us today.
It was my pleasure.
That was Christopher Sabine, an oceanographer at Manoa. We'll have a link to the recent study of ocean carbon sequestration posted with the story at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Blue Note Hawaii, located in the Outrigger Waikiki. British synth pop artist Howard Jones celebrates the 35th anniversary of his album Humans Lib this Friday and Saturday. BlueNoteHawaii.com.
In today's backyard quiz, we asked you how Kilauea and Haleakala came to be designated as national parks and for the royal responsible for introducing that legislation. Well, here's the story. Theodore Roosevelt, often called the conservation president, had a huge impact on the national park system well beyond his term in office. His vision to grow the number of parks was carried out by Woodrow Wilson's administration, which created the National Park Service in 1916. That was also the year when Wilson signed a bill introduced by Hawaii's congressional delegate, creating Hawaii National Park and both Kilauea and Haleakala into federally protected areas. Congress took several years to back up the measure with funding. One Oregon congressman complained, "It should not cost anything to run a volcano." But the money came through eventually. It is all part of the rich legacy of then-Congressional Delegate Jonah Kuhiu Kalani'aniʻole, who we honor today with a holiday. And congratulations to Janet Murphy from Kailua. You got it right. We got lots of calls on this one. So if you have an idea for a backyard quiz, email us at hawaiipublicradio.org. It's hats off to Manoa Valley Theater and its 50-year history. To mark the event, it is showcasing a production of the drama Allegiance. Thanks to Central Pacific Bank Foundation, it's presenting the Hawaii premiere of the true life experience of actor George Takei, who many of us grew up knowing as a beloved Star Trek character. Now, Paul Maitri is the guest director of the production, which, by the way, is not playing at Manoa Valley, but at the historic Hawaii Theater. So mark your calendars.
This one is a different one, and it's in a way it's kind of separate from the rest of the season. It's going to be performed at the Hawaii Theater for only 2 weeks. We're cramming about 14 shows into you know, like 11 days. And we have, I think, for one of the first times for MVT, we've hired some equity guest artists to come in, including Kathleen Stewart, who is a local girl, but she was working and living on Broadway in New York. So we've brought her back to play the role of Nurse Hannah. And then Ethan Lee Fong, who played Sammy in the Los Angeles production with George Takei. Both Dwight, Kip, and I all saw that production, and he was marvelous. He was absolutely great, and we thought if there's any way we can bring him out too. Plus, he has that that legacy and pedigree of doing the show.
We have a clip of him. You want to set the stage?
So his character, Sammy, is the whole family has been thrown into the concentration camps, and he wants to enlist to show his loyalty to America, especially with the hopes that then they would let his family free. That wasn't actually the case, but he was really trying to do the right thing. His father was very strongly against it and says, you know, no, you have to, you know, stay with us. And so the whole show really is about divided loyalty. Where does your allegiance lie? And in this song, Sammy is trying to figure that out because he's absolutely trapped and caught in between two allegiances. And in this song, he tries to figure out for himself, what do I need to do? Where does my allegiance lie?
Okay, let's take a listen.
It's time we took action and found a way out of this place. Set an example, help others to see beyond race. Although my face resembles our enemies in war, I am still American, nothing less and nothing more. I may not be a scholar, much as Pop wants me to be, but I'm not some nameless body in a crowd. If Pop would only see the soldier I could be, I'll finally find a way to make him proud. I'll finally find a way to make me proud.
And it gets better.
It does. The song is called What Makes a Man, and that's the next line that he sings. And the rest of it is trying to figure out, you know, what is it that, and it's just a great line in there, you know, what is it that defines me as a man, as a person, as a son, as an American, you know, what is it? And he has to make some really hard decisions. And so do the rest of the internees as well. It isn't just, oh, everybody sign up, enlist, and join the 442. Some of them decided to burn their draft notices. They felt that, you know, again, they were going to resist, and there is a song called Resist. They were going to try to stand up for what they believe in. So it isn't a show that says there is a right way and a wrong way. It really tries to say these people were caught in a very untenable situation. What do you do in that?
So this production, though, short run, lots of moving pieces, but people need to know and mark their calendars because it's really going to be an experience.
This is a landmark musical. I really, really believe that. It is such an important story, and because the whole story of the internment camps was hidden for so many decades, and only recently has it really begun to even be taught in the schools, and I'm pretty sure it's not taught in all the schools. So getting that word out that this is what happened, and especially in today's world where with other immigration bans happening, this is not an isolated event. This is something that could easily happen right now. Some of the bans that, you know, that the administration is talking about, very similar to the immigration ban of 1924, that pretty much led directly to the Executive Order 9066.
So we have the incredible stories here that people have lived, and it comes at a time when a lot of our veterans, a lot of the folks that were in the 442nd are passing on. Mm-hmm. You know, we just recently had Ted Tsukiyama pass as well. And so a lot of those stories really need to be kept alive, and it's through productions like this that kind of shine the light on this time in our history.
Right. I think that theater, its primary goal is to tell stories and to keep stories alive. And since this story needs to be told, needs to get out there, and especially with the generations passing, it is just a vital, vital piece. On Broadway, it was short-lived, but I think it was before its time. If it had come a year and a half later, it would have been so timely.
So we have then this showpiece, I guess, for the 50th anniversary of Manoa Valley Theater. But I don't know, was it difficult to come to this decision? Like, yes, we're going to do this one?
I wasn't privy to those talks, but I'm pretty sure that as soon as the rights for Allegiance were released, I'm pretty sure that every theater in town tried to get it. And I think for Manoa Valley especially, they felt very, very proud to be the standard bearer for this show, to be the ones to bring it to Hawaii.
And you had such a varied season this year.
Yeah. It's what I love about working with Manoa Valley is that they really try to have something for everybody. You'll have your comedies, you'll have your dramas, you'll have even like in Shipment Day, you'll have local stories being told. And then you'll have your edgy musicals, and then you'll have a musical like this.
That was director Paul Mitri talking about Allegiance, the story of the internment camps, which is being presented by Manoa Valley Theater, but will be on stage at the Hawaii Theater downtown. It opens this week, Thursday, March 28th, and runs through April 7th.
Hip-hop would only see the soldier I could be. I'll finally find a way to make him proud. I'll finally find a way to make me proud. What makes a man is his dignity. When he stands for what is right, what makes a man is his loyalty. When he fights his nation's fight, what makes a man is he makes of himself when he's giving it all he can. For all our sakes, I'll do what it takes. I must be my own.
That is it for today. Up tomorrow, Noe Tanigawa will be sitting in, and we'll talk about art at Hilo's Downtown Laundry Express. Are you intrigued? I sure am. Tell us what's on your mind. Call or talk back line. Leave your comments. Call 808-792-8217. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook at The Conversation HPR. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow, won't you, for more of The Conversation.